He's the fourth person to tell me what I'm supposed to say tonight. If I don't say them, Mac, you may not sell any tapes. They all want to hear about the Arab and the Burnoose. So we'll get right to it. My name is Harriet. Scott's already told you my last name. This is not a public meeting, but it is an open meeting, and this is where we do try to preserve our anonymity. And I forgive you, Scott. I'm an alcoholic. Thank God. You know, I wouldn't have this beautiful life if I hadn't been an alcoholic and come to you people and you straightened me out. Look at me now. Oh, baby, look at me now. I'm a member of the Carl Gables group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is January 14th, 1956. And when I first came in to Alcoholics Anonymous 43 years ago, several people told me that if I ever got to be sober longer than my age, I would have accomplished something. Well, my age is still going up. And for my own good ability to account for it, I took my last drink on my 39th birthday. So that every year when January the 14th comes around, I only celebrate my sobriety date because my natal date keeps is too much for me. I can't handle that. I'd rather be 43 any day than 82. Carol told me not to forget the Arab. Scotty tells me don't forget the Burnoose. Somebody else said don't forget the Arab. I haven't forgotten any of it. Oh, boy. And I still can't remember his name. But it was a great ride. I hail from Pennsylvania originally. The northeastern Pennsylvania. I was born in Kingston. And we lived later on in a little town called Dallas, Pennsylvania. And I had quite a sheltered life. I was, my parents were comfortable. We weren't rich. We were very comfortable, very popular in the area. My father was a businessman, active in business groups, and played golf and tennis and was a well-liked man. My mother had gone to college in Washington, D.C. in the time when not too many women did that. And she was one of the first women in our part of Pennsylvania to not only to drive an automobile, but to own her own automobile. And I grew up with two and three cars in the garage and educated parents. My father, a successful businessman. And they belonged to all the clubs and things that the young folks do. And they sent me to private schools. And all girls. And I think that's part of it. I think they made me an alcoholic. Because as some of you people know, I really prefer young men. I really do. When I was about 9 years old, my parents, they played a lot of bridge. And this particular night that I remember, at least I think I remember a particular night, it may have happened more than once. But this particular night, the bridge game had gone on till almost midnight, and they were getting tired of that. And they said, oh, come on, let's go down to Ray Hoddle's and get a lobster. My folks were night people, so about midnight, they woke up me because I was an only child. Many of us in Alcoholics Anonymous are only children. Many of us. If not, we're the favored child. The... The one that gets special attention, some, you know, And you listen to many speakers, they'll be an only child or they were the privileged child. And I read not too long ago, I reread the Jack Alexander article for the Saturday Evening Post that he wrote almost 50 years ago. And he knew that then. He studied us and he wrote, he said, many of these people are only children. Many of the truths that they learned in the early days are still true today about alcoholics and about Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, this particular night they got me, they had to take me, I'm an only child, and they couldn't leave me home alone. And so we went to Ray Harlow's and we were sitting there eating those steamed clams that came in a basket. You ate the clam and then you put it over the wire basket and then the lobsters came. And someone off gave me a little glass of brown stuff and said, drink this, it will help your indigestion. I didn't know I had indigestion. But I was an obedient child, and I drank it, and it was terrible. It was bitter, and it left a little white mark on my upper lip, and I licked it. I was so bad, I licked it. And as it went down and circled around, and all of a sudden, I wasn't 9 years old anymore. I was 19, and I was glamorous, and I was the prettiest young lady in the whole room. And I wanted more of that stuff. And that's the story right there. I always wanted more. I don't know what it was, probably beer, ale, whatever. It was, but that was my first drink, and I remember the... It set up what we call the compulsion. And the next drink I had was quite a few years later. I was 15 years old, getting ready to go to college that fall. And that summer, I contracted a childhood disease called the measles. And the doctor prescribed a little port wine to help me get my strength back. And it will, I'll tell you. And my daddy didn't know what a little port wine was. And he brought the bottle, set it by my bed. And the next time he looked, it was half gone. And I was passed out, had vomited and fallen out of bed. And when I came to, I said, oh, wasn't that good? I believe I was alcoholic from the beginning. I didn't become one. I was one. I am one. I was and I am. There was no drinking, of course, till I got out of college, although there probably would have been if I'd gone to a different school, but I went to a college that was under the auspices of the Methodist Church in those days. And most of the young men attending that college were what we call PKs. And some of the ladies, too. And what a PK is a preacher's kid. And the preacher's kids were studying to become ministers, and they kind of wanted to try out everything that was going so before they became ministers, so when they became ministers, they'd know what to preach against. And, of course, I was anxious to help them. And we did, I remember it was 1936 I graduated, and they were talking about prohibition being repealed. And of course, some of you don't even know what prohibition was. That's one thing about being 82 years old, you know what those darn things were. Prohibition was the law of the land, and it meant that nobody could buy liquor legally. And that's when bootlegging became the big thing in our country. And so where these preachers' kids found booze, I don't remember, have no idea. And how they got the money, I have no idea, because it was probably depression time, the greatest depression we'd ever known. So the money was short, and but they'd appear with a bottle. And I remember particularly the senior prom. And at intermission time, we came out from intermission, and I remember sitting in the car, and of course there were always two couples, one in the front and one in the back. And when that bottle appeared, and it couldn't have been a big bottle, I think I'm going to say a pint, for four people. But when I saw the bottle appear, I began to shake, because I was going to get some. And I hadn't had anything to drink, but all of a sudden I knew I was going to get a drink. And when the top came off, I could just smell it. And when it came my turn, the shivers go up and down my back as I speak of it, because I was so anxious to get that. I remembered the glow. I remembered the comfort. I remember the burning. I remember the taste. It didn't taste particularly good, but I knew what it would do for me. It would make me that glamorous person that I wanted to be. I was just a plain... I wasn't ugly. I was a pretty girl. I danced well. I had all the social graces until I got drunk. But then I'd get my turn at the bottle, and it didn't take much. But something happened. Something happened. And we go back into the dance, and I might be dancing with Scotty. And all of a sudden, I'm dancing with Graham. And I'd say, how did that happen? And I didn't know. And I did not know until I came 30 years later to Alcoholics Anonymous and found out I'd had a blackout when I was 18 years old. 19 years old, I had a blackout. Didn't know what it was. And only on this little bit of booze. It didn't take a whole bottle. It didn't take a half a thing. It was just a few sips. And that wonderful feeling that for a few seconds and not knowing who I was dancing with or when did the music stop. Went back home, away from college, graduated in 36, and went back up home and immediately began running with an older crowd who were full-blown alcoholics. I was too, but I hadn't developed quite as much as they had. And they were very sophisticated, and they were much older, and I felt that I was running with the older, sophisticated crowd. They were all of 25 years old, you know. They had graduated from the Ivy League colleges, and here I was coming along at age 19, and began drinking on almost daily, certainly weekend drinking. And I could drink a lot, but I always passed out, and I was always embarrassing my dates. And yet they liked me. I was a good date most of the time, but I couldn't hold my booze, and they knew it. And they kind of worried about me. And then we moved away to another city, and the same thing started happening. It was always that way. I couldn't hold my liquor. I got a job, and wasn't doing too well in Philadelphia, working for the Army, and World War II came along. And by this time, my job had taken me to Petersburg, Virginia, Camp Lee, in 1941. And I was beginning to miss work on Mondays, sometimes Tuesdays. And we had no excuse for any absenteeism because we knew there was a war coming and everybody was supposed to be doing their darndest. But we were partying on weekends, of course, so everybody, the officers, the civilians, we had very little social life outside of the camp. But everybody knew where everybody was all weekend. Friday nights there was a dance here, and Saturday night there was a dance at the officers' clubs, and in the daytime we were out at the pool swimming and having a fun time. And drinking, drinking, drinking. The elders drank with impunity, as the book says. But I never met impunity, you know. I couldn't drink with impunity. But I was absent a lot, and they stopped bothering to call me and saying, "Are you sick?" They knew where I was. And I began to realize that things were getting serious, and they were talking about demoting me. And again, that ego that comes along with alcoholism, or without it, either way. But being demoted from the secretary to the colonel, I couldn't undertake that. And they were talking about putting me in a secretarial pool. And having been private secretary for a long time, I didn't like that. So I began looking for the alternatives, and I thought, well, World War II is coming along, and I ought to be serving my country in uniform. And I decided to join one of the forces. And I was working for an army camp, and I didn't care for the army uniform. And if I'm going to join something, I want to look good. And in those days, like many of us, I was thin, and my hair was dark brown. I was a brunette, and I was pretty enough. And I loved life, and I was having a good time, so I wanted to look good, so I didn't care for the Army. So I looked over the uniforms, and I decided that I liked that Marine Corps. The Lady Marines, secretly known as the BAMs, they wore an olive drab skirt and a top, and then the red ascot tie. That's what got me, the red ascot tie, and a red silk cord around the hat. Now, I could have gone to the dime store and gotten a red silk scarf, I guess. But that's what led me to believe I would join the Marine Corps. And on the day that I could not make it to work, and I knew this was the day I was going to be demoted, I made my way up to Richmond, Virginia, and somehow got in the right building and answered a lot of questions, and trying to keep my, I needed a drink badly, and my hands were shaking, and all those papers they had me sign. And if you remember, and I hope you do, don't ever forget, when you try to sign your name and you're so hungover and the pen won't go in the right direction, in fact, sometimes it even shoots off like this. Especially when you're writing a bad check. Or signing a hotel register under the wrong name. But I signed them all, and I answered a lot of questions, and then he had me raise my hand, and he swore me in, and then he shook my hand, and he said, "Welcome to the United States Navy." And I said, sir, I called him sir. I knew how to do that. And I said, "I came here to join the Marine Corps." And he said, "Honey, you got off on the wrong floor. And you're in the Navy now." Navy blue. Never got a red scarf. To your health. They sent me to Northampton, Massachusetts, to officer training school, and I became an ensign. And of course, later on, they promoted me to lieutenant junior grade. I was a supply corps officer, and I was in charge of 6 warehouses full of ammunition. Now, that ammunition, you want to be very glad, this was an ammunition depot, Hingham, Massachusetts, and the ammunition had already been used. And after it was shot off and used, they brought it back to supply corps to do something with it. I have no idea what they did with it. I had 2 civilian workers to handle that, and I had 8 colored seamen. And those seamen were my loves. I can remember them so fondly. They were they did a lot of the physical work. And they assigned to us a Jeep, a pickup truck, and a forklift truck. And on the martini days, I took the forklift. And the first few times, my wonderful seamen would they practically lay on the floor laughing, holding their sides. They were having such fun watching their lieutenant tool around this ammunition with a forklift truck. The forks going up and down, the 2 wheels turning corners and screeching around. We wore very short skirts back then, and the skirts were going, and the legs were going, and it was a ball. Everybody enjoyed it. Everybody. And then one day, and I remember this in such a fashion that I tell it this way. Cece was the leader of the group, and he was talking, whispering to the others in his group, and I don't know whether he whispered it out loud so that I could hear it or whether I thought it, it's very vague, but what I heard him say, "Who is this woman? She used to be such fun. She was such a nice lady. Listen to her. Where did she learn that kind of language? She learned that from us. She learned this street talk. We don't like her anymore. What's happened to her? She's a drunk. And he's sharing this with his buddies. Now, I heard it, and I think he went for me to hear it. And yet I think he was trying to put on that he was sharing it with his friend and not telling me. But whatever it was, I said, "He's telling the truth. I know that. I didn't know anybody else knew it, but I knew it. I already knew it." And now he was telling me, somehow in this wonderful fashion, that they knew it. And if they knew it, the whole camp knew it. And I began to realize that whatever I had been doing was everybody's business. And I was in a Navy uniform. I was proud of my country. I was a patriotic kind of person. I salute my flag today. It hurt me terribly. I just felt that I had disgraced the whole United States. But it didn't stop my drinking. I had to keep it up. I had no choice. Shore Patrol picked me up a few times on that run from Boston down to Hingham, but they always took me home. They never did put me in a brig or anything. They just took me home because I was a woman, because I was an officer, and there weren't too many of us back there in 1940s. I remember gathering up my empty whiskey bottles out of the, because I didn't know what to do with empty whiskey bottles. And they were piling up in my closet. And so I gathered them all up one day, and I put them in two or three big paper bags, and I took them to a liquor store. And I said, "You take back empty bottles?" And he said, "Sure." He said, "Sure." So I started to dump out all these empty whiskey, scotch bottles, you know. He says, "Ah, you don't want those." He said, "Put them in the dump over there." I said, "What does he mean?" I thought they took back bottles. So I had to take them out and put all those bottles down there. Oh, these terrible things. And I was a lieutenant in the United States Navy. Shameful, shameful. Well, I got out of the Navy in good order. I don't know how, but I did. And I was in the Pentagon building one afternoon. I went by to say hello to some friends, but I saw a recruiting sign. And that recruiting sign got me, that's what got me to North Africa. I signed up to go to North Africa in 1943-44, right after the war. Oh, God. Well, a whole bunch of us went together, and I don't think but one or two were not alcoholics. The rest of us were. And that's where I met my Arab. Now, my Arab was not just any ordinary fellow, I'll tell you. He was a chieftain. He had a title. He was called a Kaid. The Kaid is like the mayor. He's like the mayor of, I was going to say Hialeah. I don't think that's a good idea. I'm not too fond of any of our mayors. But he was the mayor of an oasis called Busada. And he wore the robes, and you've seen them on television with the robes and the cape and the hood and all this business. And he was a very romantic figure. And he was the oasis, Busada, was a few hours away from the city of Algiers, where I was stationed in the Hotel St. George there. The army had just moved out. General Eisenhower, yes, had been in that same hotel. And so we went out to his oasis, from there we rode our camels out into the Sahara Desert. And I swear to you, I have to share with you that most of this absolutely is true. There is a small part that I'm not sure of. I don't know whether it was dreamy or alcohol-induced, but by God, I remember it. He was a very nice man. And we went out into the Sahara on these camels, and there we are in this tent. And I swear to God, it was just like in the movies. The tent was not just a plain, ordinary canvas thing. It was white with old gold trimmings, and inside there was a little boy over here fanning, pulling a rope, and the fan went. And somebody was feeding me grapes. And somehow or other, the State Department came a-knocking on the tent door and said, "Get out of here, let's get back to work." And so my Arab and I, and as I said, I cannot remember this man's name. But he's riding there on his camel right ahead of me, and I'm admiring his burnous. Now, a burnous is a cape-like affair, as I said, and it's just draped so beautifully. And to me, it was white silk, and it was gorgeous. It was Rudolph Valentino and all the wonderful Douglas Fairbanks is rolled into one. And I wanted that burnous. And that was okay, because he said he liked my navy raincoat. So we traded. And for all I know, the navy raincoat is still out there in the Sahara. But I wore this burnous home as an evening wrap, because sure enough, when I got back to the oasis, and the State Department escorted me home in a very lovely liner, and I used my burnous as an evening wrap. And I was on board this very nice ship and wearing my burnous, and I thought I was a spy. And I would wrap this burnous around me, and I'd pull it up, you know, like this. And I would lurk in corners, and I'd watch you go by. I wanted to know what you were doing and how you were doing it, and I just kept track of everybody on the boat. And one day, in a moment of some kind of sobriety or being aware of my surroundings, I looked at that burnous carefully, and it was not made of the beautiful white silk that I thought. It was not the gorgeous, lovely, graceful. It was brown, it was dirty brown, and it was full of moth holes, and it had been around too many goats and sheep, and it literally stunk. It really did. And I thought I was the glamour puss of, I thought it was the Mata Hari of World War II. I don't know whatever happened to that thing, but in 1955, I was asked to resign from the State Department. And I turned in my identification card, and I headed for Florida. I had married a merchant marine officer over in Italy, and that's another story, another trip. And I had read, my reading material was limited in those days. I was reading the Farmer's Almanac, and I read that you could get a quickie divorce in certain places, and Florida was one of them. So I came to Florida to get a quickie divorce from my merchant marine captain. And on the way, I kept getting drunker. I ended up in Jacksonville, Florida. And I called my cousin who lived here in Key Biscayne. And she, in turn, called Alcoholics Anonymous in Jacksonville, Florida. She just picked a number at random when the operator asked what she, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And by some very good fortune, she was connected with the San Marco Clubhouse in Jacksonville, which is a very lovely, lovely AA meeting room. And there happened to be two ladies there. And they said, we will go on this 12-step call. I was holed up at a hotel in Jacksonville. And these two ladies came to my hotel room, and they saw how sick I was, and they sat by my bedside. And the one lady said to me, my name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. And I looked at her, and she was so beautiful. She was clean. She'd had a bath that day. She had just washed her hair, it shone. Her nails were manicured. Her dress was spotless. Her hose had no runs in it at all. And she had on her makeup where the makeup belonged. The lipstick on her lips and the eyebrow pencil on her eyebrows. And she was an alcoholic, she said. And her friend, she said, I'm an alcoholic too. And she was just as pretty in her way as Pat was. And they said, we're going to take you to a hospital where you can get well. And I did. I went with them. And I have letters back and forth from the doctors and from AA people to my parents in Washington. You see, my parents had finally done the very best thing for me. They finally said, no more, you're on your own. They stopped taking me back. They stopped giving me money. They stopped giving me everything. They said, no more, we've had it. They loved me, but they were through. And that was the best thing, because I had to do something for myself. It had finally come to this in Jacksonville, Florida. And so they hospitalized me, and I began to get well. They saw how very long-term ill I was, and they arranged for me to go to the Veterans Hospital in Salisbury, North Carolina. And I had those visions of grandeur. I thought I'd been to a naval hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, just outside of Washington, where all the big shots go, Bethesda Naval Hospital. You know, the president goes there for his physicals, and the congressmen and the senators. So I'm going to a naval hospital, and certainly I'm going to get a room by myself and send out for my dinners and all this. Well, they put me in the bad, violent ward, Ward D. And I that week that I spent in Ward D is the best experience in my life. I was put in with women who were, several of them were, they're still there if they're still alive, because they were so mentally ill. Most of these women were nurses. They had seen active duty, and many of them would never see the light of outside again. A few were alcoholics. We did meet, and we had some good talks. But mostly they were just mentally ill. But I, being in that room with the absolutely violently ill, if you've never played bridge with three women who are mentally ill and violent, and suddenly right in the middle of a hand, everything goes up, and, you know, and you reach over to share the newspaper, and they throw it at you and scream. And I've seen them locked up in the straitjackets. I've seen them come out of the shock treatment room, walk like zombies. And when they went in, they were kind of normal. Not real normal, none of us were. But they'd come out like absolute zombies, like you see in the movies. And that week that I spent there was a lesson I never forget. Then I was graduated to Ward A, the good ward. I have no idea to this day what they do in between in Ward B and C. But in Ward A, I got to go to OT, that's occupational therapy. I made ashtrays, I made belts. I fell in love with my psychiatrist. We had PT, that's physical therapy. I don't know how to bowl, but I could set the pins, and I did. I was a pin setter. They didn't have electric pins. We had HT. Oh, I loved HT. Hydrotherapy. You lay in a bathtub with a rubber thing over you, and you just lay there, and the warm water keeps circulating around. Oh, I'd like to go back there sometimes. And it came to be Christmas time. And I found out since that many, if not all, of these places put on the Christmas play at Christmas time. So I was elected to be King Herod for the Christmas pageant. And we had all the characters. We had nice costumes. I had a red robe and a crown. And I must have been having a good time. I remember my doctor saying, "Now, if you laugh, Harriet, I'm going to put you out of the show," because I was having a good time. You know, putting on a little act and having a showtime. And so the most interesting thing and the most exciting thing that happened with the Christmas play was three of our shepherds escaped Christmas night. And I tell you truly, there has not been a Christmas since in these 43 years that I don't think of the citizens of Salisbury, North Carolina, looking out for Santa Claus, and they see shepherds running down the street. And it was during this time, too, that I sat in that day room and meditated on my life. And as I know the big book today, and as I know our program today, what I was doing was going back through my life and taking a good, hard look at me, and wondering what was a nice lady like me doing in a joint like this. And I knew that I was powerless over alcohol, and that I was going to go to these AA meetings that they had been dragging me to. People came and took me out to meetings, and they were so nice to me, and I was kind of afraid of them. I didn't want to touch them because I was dirty, and you all look so clean, and I didn't want to get my dirt onto you. I spent the first month of my sobriety taking baths and showers, and I didn't know I was trying to get off that dirt that was only on the inside. It isn't until we get clean on the inside that I could become clean. But I scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed, and it was still there until I began to understand that sobriety is more than just stopping drinking. Sobriety is learning how to live in a manner according to our principles of becoming adults and becoming responsible people. And there I was sitting in that day room going back through my life, and I compared it to that burnous. And I said it was my life was just as dirty as that old burnous. And when I finally looked at it the way I was looking, it could get clean again. It was dirty. I thought I'd been having such a glamorous life and had known so many glamorous people and exciting people, and I had. I had a lot of fun in my drinking days, and if you didn't, I'm really sorry. Yeah, really. But I thought it was a lot more exciting and fun than it was. It was dirty, just like that burnoose, and full of grit and holes and dirty people. And, oh, my God, those dirty, dirty bars and the dirty people and the dirty toilets. Oh, my God. You know, it was terrible. And so on January the 9th in Salisbury, North Carolina, they pronounced me as fit to go out into society again. And I said, go out there and don't drink like that anymore. And I pondered. I said, what do you mean, drink like that? I only knew one way to drink. And so I got drunk. 4.5 months in somebody's hospital, no alcohol, had taken a look into my past, had realized why I was there. I was sane. And here I picked up a drink and do not remember buying it. When people tell me they don't remember it, I believe them because I don't remember. But I'm standing in front of a mirror in a ladies' room someplace between North Carolina and Jacksonville, Florida, and I'm looking in the mirror and taking this drink out of the bottle. And I said, my God, I must be crazy. I'm an alcoholic and I'm drinking right out of a mental ward. I've been in the mental hospital because of my drinking. I must be crazy. And I might go to these AA people and ask them how to live, how to do this. I admitted, I accepted, and I was willing to go to any lengths right then and there. But I had taken the drink and the compulsion had started, and I had to take another and another. And I got into Miami on Saturday morning, January the 14th, and it was my 39th birthday. And I had been drinking all the way down. And drinking on a train in those days, if you were not in the Pullman car, which I favored, of course, there was a water tank. The way I remember it, it looks like a fire extinguisher, but it's got a water in it. Tastes more like a fire extinguisher. And you had to push a button to get the water out of a spigot, and you'd have to hold the cup underneath that. And then you had to push the button to put the water in. Then to get the whiskey, you had to hold the water. And then you had to open the bottle, and you had the other hand, and you'd have to get your teeth into the act because you didn't have enough hands. There was no place to sit anything. And I'm crying because I need the drink, and I can't get everything going. And I just cried. And I came into the old FEC station down by the courthouse. And I got off that train, and I was 39 years old, and I didn't know what to do. And I started to pour another drink into that glass, a paper cup. And I said words that maybe I had said 1,000 times before, but this time they were so simple, and I don't know if I said them out loud or if I whispered or if it was all in my heart, but I said, please God, no more. That's all I remember. Maybe I said something more, but all I remember, please God, no more. And I put the thing down, and I have not had a drink since. And that's 43 years ago. And being 43 years sober is an achievement. I didn't think I'd live, 43 hours or 43 days or 43 months. And here it's been 43 years. When I celebrate birthdays in January, I don't think about the book. The book says we were reborn, and I was reborn. And that's what I count, 43, damn it, whether you like it or not. That's how old I am. I went to a wonderful place we had in those days called the Anana Club. And I climbed those steps, and I was met at the top of the steps by a man named Freddie Kay. And when you read your book, Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, you'll find Freddie Kay in there. Freddie Kay came down from New Jersey and brought some sobriety with him, and he was one of our leaders in those early days in 1956. How many in this room have read thoroughly AA Comes of Age? That's pretty good, but it's pretty rotten, too, I'll tell you. If you care about service and general service, or you care about your fellowship, I strongly recommend that you read AA Comes of Age. It's hard getting into it, I grant you, but you don't have to read it all at once, and you don't even have to start at the beginning. Just pick it up and start reading somewhere that looks interesting and read it again, then go on to another paragraph. But please, please read it. and share it with others. It's a wonderful book. This is the history of what has saved your life. You should care about it. And there are pictures in it, too. And I joined a group, and they said, why did you join this group? I said, because you asked me. Today I don't hear the group say, would you like to be a member of our group? You've come here now 2 or 3 times if you like that. Would you like to be a member? Of course we want to be a member of society. Of course I wanted to be a member. I hadn't been a member of anything for years. Of course I said yes. And then pretty soon they gave me an envelope with some rattling money. I think it was $3.98 or $4.69, something like that. And they said I was the treasurer. They didn't ask me, they told me. And I guarded that like money like it was $3 million. And then pretty soon they said, you're going to go to intergroup now. I said, what do I do? They said, well, every month you go and you report and listen, and then you come back and tell us what happened. Well, I did that. You can't believe what I told them I heard, because I never knew what I was hearing. I went to intergroup and didn't understand a word. But what I began to learn was responsibility. I began to be on time. I answered the roll call. I began to be reliable. I began to get some common sense in my life, some order in my life, some discipline. Discipline, that's the word I was looking for. I began to get some discipline. And I was staying sober and loving it. And then I met a man. First, I was reading the newspapers looking for a job. And I'd read the ads to my friends and they'd say, no, not yet. And I'd say, well, I've got this to do. And I said, no, not yet. And I said, well, I've got to move into an apartment. No, not yet. I was staying with my cousin. I'll keep this game. And they kept saying, no, not yet. And then finally, one day, and there was a newspaper ad, and it said, secretary wanted temporary, one day at a time. And they said I could take that job. So I reported it for duty. I went to the employment agency. And she asked me for my references. And I said, I don't have any. I'm just here from Washington, D.C., where I was fired because of my drinking. And I've joined AA 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and her mouth was open. And I said, I'm a good stenotypist. I'm a secretary, and I can do most anything in an office. And she just sat there with her mouth open, staring at me. And I said, I need a job. Well, she just said, okay, you go over there and get an interview. So I went over to this office in the old Dade Commonwealth building. And one fellow was on his honeymoon. The other fellow was out to lunch. I found out later he took very long lunch hours, and he had a problem. And the third one was sitting with his feet up on the desk reading the newspaper. That was Lou. And I told Lou, I said, I'm new in town. I've just joined Alcoholics. His feet came off the desk. And he says, you're hired. I said, oh, I can only stay 1 or 2 days. And he said, well, that's all right. Marge has been sick, and we do need someone for a couple of days. But if you can come back today, that's fine. So I stayed, and I couldn't even touch the typewriter. Didn't take the cover off. And when the phone rang, I jumped. But Lou told me at the end of the day, he said, Harriet, he said, Marge did call, and she'd like another day or two. Could you come back tomorrow? I said, yes, I can come back one more day. So I went back up to the Anana Club, and I said, they want me to come back one more day. And I said, that's okay. One more day, I'll be okay. Oh, good. So I kept going back one day at a time for 16 years. They made me a member of the firm. I was the treasurer and handled all the books. And they also gave me the key to the liquor cabinet. I was the only one they could trust. And it turned out the second member who was absent that day was on his honeymoon, and his little bride was 18 years old, a darling girl, and she's now a member of AA for 7 years. He died, and I believe alcohol had a part in it, but she came to AA, and it's a nice reunion. A lot of wonderful things have happened in my sobriety, and if you've been sober any length of time, you know that these things happen. My parents came down here to Florida to make their last days with near me. And That was good. I had not been a very faithful or good daughter. I'd done. It really, that's the worst thing that bothers me, because I was not the good daughter I've been brought up to be. But I did the best I could, and that's the only consolation I have, was the best I could under the circumstances. But when I met that gentleman who I told you about, he was a member of the Anana Club, an alcoholic, and he told me he'd been around for 16 years. And I didn't know that being around AA was different. And I married him. And I found out too late that he had been just around and around and around, and he'd picked up many white chips. And Bob never could stay sober. We were married 16 years before he died. And during that time, he had two different periods of a year each that I believe he was sober. But in between, he had many, many, many slips. And after the second one, he never did stay sober at any time at all. I finally divorced him, and he remarried, and somehow or other, the young lady stayed sober, but he died of alcoholism and pills, and pills. Please, you know, bad enough for one, but to mix it all up. This man knew the program, and I talked to him. I would wake him up in the middle of the night, and I would tell him some more fifth step stuff. I took fourth and fifth steps with him, and he knew the book, and he knew Alcoholics Anonymous, and he loved it. And it was good for me. I'm not sure, but maybe I wouldn't have stayed sober if I hadn't met and married Bob. He was a wonderful listener. He gave me good advice, and he was always ready to listen and help. He was always there for me. And I loved him. I really did. And even at his worst. And it's okay. I'm sorry he couldn't make it, but he helped me. I would not be here today, I believe, if it were not for Bob Rawls and his faith in me. Many's the time when I remember one time I actually threatened to pick up a drink with him. He was so drunk and he was teetering, and I picked up the bottle in anger and I said, "I'm going to get drunk with you." He says, "You don't think much of your sobriety, do you?" And then he fell down, you know. He was proud of me and proud of my sobriety, which is not really the right terminology, but he was, and it made me proud of that too. Alcoholics Anonymous is a lifesaver. It's a soul saver. It's a God-given program, I believe. And I think we should treat it as such. Those of you who are here tonight who are members of the general service structure, I know there are some people here who are not. They're just here because it's a meeting a little different than they're accustomed to. And I brought my manual with me just for that purpose. If you don't know what general service is, it's in this book pretty much. It's called the AA Service Manual. And this is read even less than AA comes of age. But Bill wrote in the AA's Legacy of Service. What is service? What is general service? Our 12th step, carrying the message, is the basic service that the AA Fellowship gives. This is our principal aim and the main reason for our existence. The main reason for our existence. Therefore, AA is more than a set of principles. It's a society of alcoholics in action. We must carry the message, else we ourselves can wither, and those who haven't been given the truth may die. And you know, some of us have watched people die. Hence, an AA service is anything whatever that helps us to reach a fellow sufferer, ranging all the way from the 12-step itself to a 10-cent phone call and a cup of coffee, and to AA's General Service Office for national and international action. The sum total of all these services is our third legacy of service. Services include meeting places, hospitals, intergroup offices. They mean pamphlets, books, and good publicity of almost every description. They call for committees, delegates, trustees, and conferences. And not to be forgotten, they need voluntary money contributions from within the fellowship. This is what AA is made up of: general service and intergroup and individuals who try to carry the message in all these different ways. Some carry the message one way, some others. This is a wonderful group. When things were at my very worst, I had been intergroup. You folks let me be the delegate to New York, and I had been, I became the first intergroup chairman, woman, first woman to be intergroup chairman, and I had done all these things. And I was unhappy and miserable, and my husband was giving me a big problem with getting into and out of jails and all this business. And I was about at my wit's end. My parents had died. And I thought life was over. I really did. And I remember I had had the roast chicken. And like many people, I had taken the wishbone and put it up on the windowsill in a glass. And this particular day, I reached for that wishbone. And I turned around and I threw myself on the floor crying because I had nobody. First time in my life, I didn't have somebody to pull a wishbone with. And I knew my life was over. And I threw myself on the floor and I said, God, is this all there is? I've done everything that I've been asked to do and more, and I've got to have some relief. Please, God, help me. And the phone rang. It was God in the fashion. I don't know. And I don't remember who it was, but she said, come and go with us to the General Service quarterly meeting. I said, I don't want to go to that dumb old business meeting. I've heard about you people. You think you're running AA. You think you're the people that you're the judge and jury. You better come with us. So I went. And oh my God, I'm so glad. I sat there in the back row and it was mean. You know, I was writing notes to people and I was whispering. If I catch you whispering, I'll clobber you. I've clobbered one or two in my life. But I was doing all that bad stuff in the back row because I was bored. I didn't understand one word. And maybe some of you don't either, but that's Sunday. Yeah. But anyway, all of a sudden, there were two people in particular I remember. One was a lady named Pat, and there was another one named Bobby, Bobby O.B. And these two people, they were so alive and so enthusiastic and talking about things that I never heard of. I said, I want more of that. And I literally got up from the back row and walked up to the front row and sat right next to Helen. And I said, I want to hear more. Oh, my God, it just turned my whole life around. This General Service, if you're bored anywhere, come to General Service. We'll unbore you. It won't happen immediately, maybe, like it did with me. It took time. You know, I still don't understand this whole book. My God, I don't understand half of it. But I'm still trying to read it, and I'm still reading it, and I'm still trying to share it. And the traditions, oh, please. Listen, go to all the tradition meetings. Have more tradition meetings in your groups, please, because this is what's holding us together. Let Alcoholics Anonymous reign forever. You know, we could wreck it. We ourselves, it will come from within. Don't let it happen to us. It saved my life, and if you're here tonight because of it, it saved your life, too, and I'm so glad. We're a good-looking bunch. Thank you.